interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
So, fall of 2021, I'm working in the office, and I get a phone call from Homicide Cold Case, NYPD Homicide, and they're like, yo, we have this really crazy scenario, and we want to know, you know, like, you know, what's your take on it, being a sketch artist and stuff, like, you know, what can you do? I never tell anybody no. I'm always like, hit me with it. I'll take care of it on the back, you know, I'll have to do all the figuring out on the back end. So the scenario, it's a pretty wild case. 2019, and correct me if any little details are wrong, whatever, but 2019, a woman's doing therapy. She has a recollection of her old stepdad, who was a piece of shit, that he had her, he came home with two garbage bags of body parts and had her bury him in the backyard. And this is back in like 1976. So the psychiatrist is therapist is like, yo, you need to go call the cops. So she calls the local detectives, you know, NYPD detectives, and calls them up. They're both like, you know, like, how do you know there was a body in here? And she said that there was a bone that punctured out the bag and stabbed her.
Oh.
So they're like, whoa. So this is all common. This is all over the news. They get a warrant. They find out the old address. They get a warrant. They bring the cadaver dogs in. Dogs sit right away. Boom. They know there's a body back there. They dig it up and they find the remains of a gentleman. So the man that they were looking for was, what do you call it? They didn't get any ID hits with DNA. The guy had never been arrested, but they end up with genealogy, familiar DNA testing. Mm-hmm. They find five relatives that remembered that their uncle, he was in his 80s and the 70s, he went missing. So they find the missing report from him in the 70s, and they have five relatives. So they're like, listen, can you draw a picture of kind of like what this guy looks like based on the DNA report, his family photos of his five relatives, and his missing report? I'm like, yeah, no problem, I got this. So it's a pretty tall order, right? Yeah. But like, you know, I just slow it down, I break it down. You look at all the family members, they all have the same, like, very familiar, similar facial features. I look at the missing report, I can tell how, you know, old he was, his weight, you know, kind of like, they said he was kind of like a, what do you call it? Like, not a homeless guy, but like, you know, just kind of like not showering all the time, disheveled a little bit. He carried lots of money in his pockets. That was like one of the things. So that ends up being one of the parts of the, like, he gets murdered over money that he was carrying. So, you know, I look at the relatives. So I put together the picture. So I spent, you know, a couple days, I put together a picture of this guy, beard, no beard, you know, bald hair, like 30 different variations. We show it to one of the relatives. The relative is like, yo, it looks really good. This one is the closest that I think.
Mm.
Okay. So that night, a family photo shows up. One of the family members finds this old photo of him from 1918 in his World War I uniform. Oh. So he's like, what is his 20s or whatever? So all that work I did, it's all out the door. They're like, can you take this picture and you age progress it? I'm like, absolutely. So I age progress the picture, and they put it out there. So they end up arresting the guy gets ID'd with, you know, through DNA, through the photograph, you know, that it was a barber guy. So the guy's barber, I guess, invited him in after hours for a haircut, killed him, dismembered him, and brought his body parts back. So, you know, pretty wild. So, you know, the sketches everywhere, they show the thing, they do the detectives on the job case, amazing guys. One of the guys I knew personally, I went to homicide school with him. Awesome. And it just all came together. So the guy was going to fight in court. We're getting ready to do the whole big, you know, it's going to be a big trial and everything, you know, Queens DA's office, everything with homicide. And the last second, get a phone call. We don't need you. He pled out. So he took a plea. I think he took 20 years. He's in his mid 70s, but he's going away to jail forever. So that was all over the news and everything. Really cool case. I've done so many cold cases that just, you know, they just, you know, they don't really go anywhere because it's such a hard shot in the dark. You know, the NYPD firing on all cylinders and do everything it can possibly to, you know, solve some of these cases. But the cold cases are very, very hard. To see this one on the way out of my career, you know, come full circle and the guy go to jail for a murder he did in 1976, wild. You know, just think about that guy. He definitely, in my opinion, he definitely killed other people.
Yeah. As soon as you said dismemberment, I'm like, dude, like this is. Yeah, this isn't the first time he's done it. And
imagine getting a knock at your door and be like, yo, we think somebody's, you know, buried in your backyard. You're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
It was, you know, everybody on that case, top, you know, NYPD's definitely got some really, you know, I'm just great detectives. I'm just glad to be a piece of that, you know. But it was cool during the press conferences and then the news seeing like my picture up there and everything.
So, yeah, that and also that a lot of people always assume because of the TV shows. There's one detective working a homicide. Maybe that person has a partner and they do all the work when really in reality, homicides are team effort.
Yeah.
And like you're not the most successful homicide units tap into that, those resources. Hey, you know, we got Matt Klein down here who can do a sketch artist. Yeah. He can sketch this out, which brings me actually into talking about who you are. Like we just got right into that. So Ski, we finally got Matt here on the show. This is before I get way into the story. For everybody listening, this is Matt Klein, who is retired now, correct?
Yep.
Yeah, retired 31st. Now. Retired NYPD, was patrol officer, detective, eventually got into their was a composite art unit or composite sketch artist. So like the pictures you see on the news or in Dateline and all these specials, he's one of those people that can do that. On top of also having Battle Tribe, like just this outstanding clothing line, merchandise, really just almost like grassroots, word of mouth. Everybody's sharing his pictures and saying, hey, check this dude's art stuff out, to where he's got a really, really good thing running with that. And we're going to get into that too. And also on top of like having what I would sometimes consider, because we've talked in the past, like a photographic memory with sci-fi movie, you know, pop art, 80s and 90s movie references and stuff. So it is cool, though, that we start out like that when you were talking about that case. And when you get into cold case work, and right now that's kind of like the buzz for a lot of people when they're wanting to go back and listen to podcasts, or they're wanting to follow up on, like, you know, this category of true crime thing. And then people that actually live it and work these cases and have interviews and access with family members and stuff, they call them cold cases. We always refer to them as unsolved, you know, because it's they're not always cold. It's just they're not solved yet. At least that's kind of how we look at it where I am. But I say that to say you talked about that case, which was from 1976. Complete stranger lures a guy basically in to do a haircut, probably already knew that he carried a lot of money, kills him, dismembers him, which we just said is probably not his first murder, in 1976. And then two or three, four decades later, technology merges with the pencil to paper or the artist, you know, rendering of something. And then you end up able to work it backwards and identify somebody. To me, that's just badass. And not many people get to work stuff like that. So yes.
And you got to deal with your childhood trauma, man. Kudos to this lady for finally talking to somebody, right?
Yeah, man. That's it's wild too. Cause my good friend, this guy, Detective Contreras, awesome dude, man. Guy's stud. That was the thing too. It's like, you look at the case, you look at the lineup of people involved, all studs. And, you know, he's working a regular squad in a precinct, and he gets that phone call. It's like, and it ends up being his baby, and it explodes. You know, they bring other people in, you know, cold case and homicide and stuff like that. But he was the initial, you know, detective and stuff. And, you know, working with the DA squad, and he was like, oh, my boy Klein, you know, let me get him on the phone, like, and get me on the phone. Like, you know, I'm like, yeah, I got you, man. I got you.
When you've been in law enforcement for a while, people's police stories and cases don't really impress you because you've heard it all, right? But I'm listening to this story and I'm like, I'm excited, right? I've been around this for a long time, but like some of the stuff you said really was just fascinating. The fact that a cadaver dog can hit on bones that were buried in 1976, right? And still, they still have the ability to track that down. That's mind blowing. And then I know you just touched the tip of the iceberg on how you actually sketch up a drawing, but like, I had no idea you would look at DNA and then take, you know, use all these different pieces of the puzzle. That's fascinating, man.
Thanks, man. Yeah, that's it's really cool, man.
So when you're talking about cadaver dogs, Keith, real quick, one thing I learned about 2 years ago, and I was the dummy. We were looking for a missing person, and this team comes out, and the guy's like, "Hey, I'll put my dog in a boat," because it was a large body of water that we were pretty certain this person probably got in the water and somehow, you know, hurt himself, whatever, and he ended up drowning. But the team's like, I'll put my cadaver dog in this boat, and we'll float out there and we'll see if we can't pick something up. I'm kind of being stupid, like, man, are they messing with me? Like, how's a dog going to sniff over water if someone is deceased underwater? Like, it just didn't make sense to me. But then, of course, the guy just looks at me when I ask him. He's like, gas and air bubbles. He's like, when the bubbles come up as the gases begin to escape a body. Yeah, because sometimes you're looking at 2, 3, 4 days, depending on the water and the climate and everything. But as the bubbles rise to the water and pop, it actually releases the same odor that you would smell on the ground for the dog or whatever. So that was pretty
crazy. Pretty wild, man.
Yeah. But that dog couldn't draw, so we're not gonna keep talking about that.
The guys that told me about the dog that went back there, they said the dog went back there and sat down right away. Like, that's crazy. It was pretty instant, you know. That's for how long he was there for, you know. It's crazy.
Yeah. So when you got into that unit, you were already like a sworn officer, detective. Yeah. Walk us through some of that, because I know about 2 seconds of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, my whole backstory was like my dad in 5 seconds. My dad was a sick artist. I got my talent from him. I just drew as a hobby on my own. I never thought it was going to be anything, because my dad's career was like feast and famine. He made a lot of money, then he made no money. He made a lot. Like, I just kind of wanted it. 9/11 kicks off. I joined the military, do the Iraq thing. Take the NYPD test while I'm in the Army down in Georgia. As soon as I get out, I get back from Iraq, my second tour of January, I get out of the Army in April. I'm on I-95 driving home up to New York. I call NYPD, started my investigation in 3 days. And then in 3 months, I was in the police academy. Boom. So like no time to breathe. Like, right in. But I became a cop. I was in the academy for like 6 months and just did, you know, I did patrol, and then I ended up doing conditions, which was sometimes we just do whatever conditions were needed to be addressed in the precinct. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I'd fill in for anti-crime or SNU, which was like the narcotics stuff that they did in the precinct. But did that, found out about the artist unit. I was like, are you kidding me? I didn't know anything about it. I had a friend that knew somebody there. They gave me a call. I went down and applied, and I took the art test, and I did well. And then I had to, but that was in 2011. So I had to wait for a guy to retire because the unit was so small. So he ended up finally retiring at the end of 2014. They picked me up in January, and then I did 8 years there, and then fell into the detective bureau, got my detective shield out of it, and had a really awesome career, you know, like going from a cop doing, you know, regular patrol and, you know, stuff, crime fighting, all that, to being able to put my hands on big cases like that. It was really, you know, very humbling, very cool. Very awesome, you know. So
yeah, do you, this is kind of a really stupid question.
No, go ahead.
Did any part of you miss being on patrol though? Like the day-to-day craziness of working patrol, or even like if you work some anti-crime stuff like that?
You know what it is you know, like in life you always want to challenge yourself. So like I kind of like did everything, like it was time for me to move on. So like if the artist unit thing didn't work out, I was going to try out for emergency service and just try to find something else to do, you know. Like I had my fill. Like I had a ton of awesome patrol stories and like, you know, I was like what else was there left for me to challenge it, you know, the challenges. I had a lot of good friends, a lot of good guys I worked with that were just going to different places, so it was my turn to like find a niche. And that's the one great thing about the NYPD is there's so many units, so many different places you can go. Scuba, aviation, you know, the firearms instructor, driver's training, highway, you know, narcotics, you know, warrants, emergency service. There's so many different places you can go if you apply yourself, you know.
So and, you leave the military and you show up to the police academy in a department as big as NYPD. How many people are in your academy class?
I don't remember the exact number. Over 1,000, maybe 1,100.
Dude, that's 1,300. I had 22 people in my academy class.
Yeah. NYPD is crazy big. Like, me and my wife were talking about the other day, and NYPD on Wikipedia is listed at 33,000 strong. Number two in the country is Chicago at 11,000. So they have we have three times the amount. It's so insane.
How do they, on like day one at the police academy, how do they wrangle a bunch of first day police recruits and actually make it so you're a little nervous to be there, man?
They do. I mean, you know, I came from the Army. Like, I was literally in Iraq, like, five months prior.
Right.
But the thing with me was, you know, I was like newly married. I was probably married for like a year or so. I had a brand new kid that was a couple months old. And, you know, I was there because I needed this job, One Life itself. You know, like, there was a website called monster.com. Like, what do you do? Infantry. And it's like, security guard, cop. And I'm like, this is it. Like, I need this. Like,
yeah,
I need this job more than anything. So I went in there kind of like, you know, I didn't have a friggin' attitude, a chip on my shoulder. Like, who the fuck am I? You know, I was shooting people, you know, 5 months ago. Like, I didn't go in there with that attitude. I went in there like, I need this job more than life itself. I'm professional. That's it. I'm doing that. So all the fucking yelling and shit, I was just like, okay. Okay. You know, like, right. you know, it's like, I remember standing in a formation with a buddy who was a Marine, and he was a Phantom Fury Marine, man. He was a bad motherfucker. And we're sitting there, and they're like, you're in the police academy, like, you're going to be on a foot post with 14 pounds of gear, and you're going to hate life. And me and him are like, yeah, okay. Yeah, hate life. Woo, you know, yeah. This Phantom Fury Marine here shaking it in boots.
Yeah. Like, so, cool. I'm carrying a salt pack. I got you.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. But like, you know, if you want to succeed, you know, okay, mm-hmm. here's the objective. We'll meet it and, you know, move on. You know, you can't wear everything on your, you know, can't have a chip on your shoulder. You got to do it.
Do you think that going through that, so you've been through, you were infantry. So you went through Fort Benning. Yeah. So your basic was basic. It was.
I did the OSAP, the ASIC AIT, the infantry school, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything's like right back to back. Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
There was like 6 months or something.
Yeah. So you go through that. You get deployed numerous times. You've done combat overseas. You come back here when you're in the police academy. Now that is not going to affect you, right? The cadre yelling at you. But do you think that is effective for the recruits? Like, in other words, does the average person coming off the street need that in an academy?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. You know, everybody's different. You know, mm-hmm. I'm glad I had the military experience before I became a police officer. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, you need it. You need the training and, you know, everything's changed. You know, now, you know, that's another whole debate and conversation. You know, they giving you the tools that's necessary for you to survive on the street. You know, that's a whole discussion. But you know, it's better than nothing. You know, like, you gotta, because being a cop is, you know, like, I went, that was my thing. It's like, I lived through all that fucking bullshit in Iraq and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm not getting killed in the NYPD. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not, you know, I survived getting blown up numerous times and firefights. Yeah. You know, getting shot over my head and all this shit, and like, I'm not getting shot by some 16-year-old kid with a friggin', you know, was a hot point?
High point.
Like, you know, like, I really, like, mm-hmm. I really fucked up in life. So I mean, like, that was always in the back of my mind, because being a police officer, you know, from, you know, all the firefights in Iraq and everything, like, I never got into a gun battle in the police department, you know, thank God. Mm-hmm. But everything is like tactical nightmare as a police officer. You're always walking in the door to, you know, Funko's Funland, you know, like, you know, people jump out of the closet. Like, you don't have that presence and that aggressive stance that you do in the military, you know, and heavy weapons and armor to the teeth. You're really walking into traps a lot, you know, domestic disputes and car stops. So,
well, and you just said a mouthful for a bunch of the listeners that are not in law enforcement. And you've got a guy telling a story about coming from Iraq, going to NYPD, and he says, thank God I was never in an officer involved shooting, right? Because there is this image that, you know, police departments recruit from the military, and then all these cops want to go out there and get in gunfights and gun battles and this and that. And I mean, you're living proof, man. Like you said, thank God I didn't get in a shootout in 20 years in NYPD, right?
Yeah.
And man, that just debunks so many myths that people have about law enforcement. So I just want to point that out.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's yo, man. Gun battles are fucking legit, man. And I was in some fucking really nasty ones in Iraq and stuff. And you know, I'm just
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, too, is that one of the reasons, and like you said, this is a whole debate about paramilitary academies versus the adult learning academy where you don't stress recruits out. You want them to learn the material. There is a debate. And Ski and I've talked about it, too. It's like you kind of have to have both. At some point, you have to push the average citizen to control their emotions and to understand you're going to be stressed. People are going to yell at you. They're going to cuss at you. They're going to pick your worst physical feature that you've worried about since puberty, and they're going to nickname you something, and everybody on the block is going to call, you know, like you have to kind of inoculate yourself to that. I also say that when we talk about recruiting, there were departments several years ago that got away from recruiting out of the military. And mm-hmm. there was this theory, higher ups, you know, chiefs and sheriffs and higher ranking police administrators, that if you were to hire somebody with a military background, they were more apt to pull the trigger and, like Ski said, look for that violent encounter. My argument was always, no, it's the opposite. Like mm-hmm. someone who, like you just said, I didn't survive overseas to come back and get blasted by a 16-year-old cocking a high point sideways and firing over the hood of a car, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, get caught slipping in a domestic violence call out or whatever. So for some people out there, and believe it or not, we do have some higher ups that listen to the show that are mm-hmm. they're really open-minded police supervisors with punk rock and music backgrounds. And we've had those discussions too, that the same yeah. thing. It's like having the prior military, the real strength in it is that that person's already kind of matured. They know how to handle stress and they're focused usually when they come to a police department. I mean, there are a few probably that are not as squared away, yeah. but like you were saying, you're not running out every night, like, you know, Lethal Weapon, trying to go out there and get into a shootout. You're trying to yeah. survive the day and probably teach your cohorts like, hey, maybe not walk through a doorway like that. Or maybe not absolutely. Stand in that doorway with your notepad in your hand and your pen, asking a guy how he split somebody's wig open.
Man, and there ain't nothing scarier than a 16, maybe 14, 15, 16-year-old kid with a gun that's out on the block.
Yeah, man.
Gangbanging, selling drugs and stuff. They're like, so dangerous, man, and often overlooked by society. Like, oh, you keep picking on these kids and this and that. Like, no, they're the dangerous ones, you know?
Well, like Matt just mentioned about Chicago PD, like being their numbers, you know, how large they are. Actually, in my opinion, how small they are compared to
– yeah.
the level of violence they're dealing with. And it seems like right. all the major cities are dealing with it. You work in New York, you live in New York. Is it like 1984 again, like Escape from New York level violence going
yeah,
on?
Yeah, it's funny. I was at a wedding and having a little bit of a not like a debate. I don't really debate anybody. Like to me, like it really never gonna change anybody's mind, but somebody I know works in Manhattan and they're like, oh, the crime's not that bad, blah, blah. I'm like, all right. And first of all, the guy looks like a what the hell is that? What was that friggin', what was that movie with the show with the bikers? The hell is it?
Sons of Anarchy?
He looks like a yeah. Sons of Anarchy biker. I'm like, bro,
okay.
Like nobody's messing with you. Yeah, so anyway, yeah. like that night, he had a Facebook post, and I don't find anybody on Facebook either, but I just sent him a screenshot of the official New York City crime statistics. Mm-hmm. And they're eye-opening, you know, and that's what's going reported. There's a lot that doesn't go reported. So crime is, you know, up, you know, it's due to the bail reform. Everybody gets, you know, locked up and they get let out right away. And, you know, there's mm-hmm. nothing they can really do about it, but yeah, crime is
too, because I mean, it's real. Like you can commit armed robbery and sign yourself out at the, I don't know, is it a magistrate in New York or you go before a judge or whatever, but you can get arrested. And then sign yourself out for a robbery. Is that correct?
They give you a desk appearance ticket. So, like, if you fall in a certain criteria, like if you're like an axe murderer, they keep you in jail. But like, if it's anything else, they give you, you know, they release you on your own reconnaissance, and you come back. They give you a court date, and you come back. So they have, and you can read it in the paper. They have people that commit like a robbery, and then mm-hmm. they go back out and they commit another robbery, and then like the amount of violent encounters with that one individual, it's eventually going to go wrong and become a murder and become
what did that do to morale for like these hard charging officers like yourself that were out there working the streets and like actually getting into like real police work and stuff, putting the handcuffs on somebody, chasing them down with a gun, just knowing that you're going to basically write them a citation and tell them to show up in court? Did it like completely destroy proactive police work? Or did you guys still go out?
I don't even have to like do it. Me, well, you know, I was a lot of the stuff's happened later in my career when I was you know, in doing the sketching. But yeah, you know, like it just makes sense, right? It's just, you know, people are locking people up for like a gun, and then they're before they're even done with the paperwork, the guys are getting released. You know, it's detrimental to the morale, but
it's conditioning also the criminal circles. Like you said, the same person is going to commit more violence. And that's what I think the average citizen does not understand when they're hearing all these newer theories of how to fight crime or how police should be reformed or whatever. It's like the problem is as old as human behavior. There's about 10% of people or less who are not always going to follow the rules and who are going to be prone to violence, either, like you said, armed robberies, aggravated assaults, domestic violence, murder, cutting up barbers, you know what I mean? Like you said, there are people that do that. And the problem is when people are charged and then there's a gap in, say, 6 months, a year, or whatever, and they already know if I get arrested, I'm walking right back out. All I got to do is get processed. I'm walking right back out. They got 6 more months or whatever to stack their money. Like, this is no joke. Like, Ski and I have worked on units where we've listened to gang members who have been charged on like serious felonies, somehow catch a bond, you know, get a bond and get money up because the gang has some resources. They get out and then they go out there and start doing licks or doing robberies or trying to rob other people to get their money up in order before they go away for, say, 2 or 3 years or whatever.
They're
not going to stop committing violence. That's the sad thing. But we know that if people were studying criminal stats and history, they would know the techniques that have been proven are proactive. It is that, like you said, like an anti-crime unit or a street crime unit, for people to go out there and know this entire block is pretty good except for this core group of dudes that are down here doing whatever, selling drugs or extorting money from businesses or committing robberies. Like, that's who we're going to focus on. You know, there was an old unit in New York. Was it the Stakeout Squad?
Like,
Yeah, I mean, I read a book on them. It was like crazy.
Murder squad.
I know there's like a lot of controversy because they got like a lot of deadly shootings. But reading a book about them, how the robberies were so, and for people listening, Google it nowadays. You can Google it or read a book, actually. But the Stakeout Squad, that's what they would do in New York because those robberies were so rampant. And it was probably just before really the drug era kind of took off. And people would rob like corner stores is what we call them in the South. And these crews would like set up basically ambushes, right? Like they just
They would go into, you know, robbery prone locations like bodegas and stuff, and they'd wait in the back with shotguns and just wait. And guys would come in and they just light them up, man. You know, and the body count started stacking, and then they were getting the, you know, not everybody was happy with that, but it just shows you what a horrible. I remember as a kid going, my dad. To work one day visiting and going to New York City. And I was like, oh my God, man, you know, it was a different world back then. You know?
There's
nothing better though than the redemption videos of like the store owners that are like, not my store. Right. And they beat them off with a broom.
Well, I mean, nowadays, like you had talked about like the High Point, you know, years ago, that's what everybody carried. Cause it's a very inexpensive pistol. Every juvenile out there. I mean, we've got units in our area stopping cars with like 3 or 4 or 5 gang members. Every one of them will have like a Glock with an extended magazine, like a little like Draco on the floorboard or in a trunk. You know, I mean, they're like, but they're all, most of them are stolen. You know what I mean? It's not like they're going to a gun store and buying it. But so I will, let me switch gears. So I do, I like the aspect of in NYPD, you have an officer who can come up through the ranks and actually get into the unit you were in drawing. Down here, we actually usually will have to contract someone who has a prior career like that. And it's pretty amazing to see it. While you've got that aspect going on, you're retired now. Battle Tribe. So if you can kind of like, I've explained it to Ski and I've explained it to a lot of other people. I'll repost your stuff just because
Thank you.
I love your art. I love the style. I also love that it's almost like you have to do it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, it's like, it just feels good to do it. But if you can just walk us through how all that kind of started.
So, So like, you know, I draw. So I started Battle Tribe in the summer of 2018, the fall of 2018. So I was kind of just looking, you know, I was starting to, one of my friends was like, oh man, your artwork's cool. You should really put it out there. And, you know, on Instagram, it's, I'm like, all right. So like, I didn't really, I'm not really tech savvy. So I kind of like looked into it. So I started putting my artwork out there, and I had this one piece I did. So I do a lot of like military, law enforcement, pop culture mashups. So I did one with stormtroopers as soldiers, and I put it up, and one of my friends saw it. He's like, oh, can I repost that on Reddit? I'm like, yeah, no problem. And it had like 60,000 likes in like one day. So I was like, oh, he's like, yo, you need to put this on a shirt and just keep doing what you're doing. So I was like, I wanted to come up with like a brand name that would be an umbrella for all my creativity so I can put it out there and, you know, obviously monetize what I'm doing and just keep, you know, keep pushing it out there. And that's what I did. So I did Battle Tribe, and it's just been off to the races, and a lot of people enjoy it. I'm very grateful, and it does very well. You know, I made it into a whole business, and you know, just keep doing that. And I do a lot of collaborations and a lot of different charity things with different companies and everything. And it's really kind of just like whatever's in my head and like what I want to do. And it's made it fun, you know, very organic. It, you know, like, it wasn't like I woke up and was like, oh, I want to do this and make, you know, make this happen. It just, I just kind of organically did it. And that's the way it continues. And I look for projects that I'm interested in, and it just keeps growing and growing. That's pretty much it.
So the badass company name.
Thanks,
by the
man.
Way.
Thank you. Yeah.
Like, well, you, I was just like, hear Battle Tribe, and I'm like, yeah, I don't even know what we're going to do, but I'm ready.
that's the thing is, like, you know, like, tribe, everybody wants to belong to a tribe, a family, everything. And then, like, I know this is going to sound a little corny, but like, you know, who's the closest ones you're with, the ones you battle with, you know, whether it's, you know, real warfare, or you know, you're hanging out and stuff, like the people you roll with, you know. So I just think that it's funny, you know, because like in the beginning, like Battle Tribe. But like, me and my wife were talking about the other day, now it's like Battle Tribe, you know, like people got, it's like a war cry almost, you know.
It is. Yeah. It's exactly the first thing that came to mind.
It's so funny.
Well, the cool thing is, like, I've got several of the shirts. I think you're actually wearing one of my favorites, which is like the Princess Leia. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's like Princess, for those like listening. It's in go to his Instagram. We're going to talk about it in just a second, and how to order all this stuff. But it's just to describe, it's Princess Leia with a kit on and like the you know, hair buns from like the first Star Wars or whatever. And when I wear that shirt, people are always like, where'd you get that? You know, because it's one, the art is just, is striking. It's a cool composition. And then on top of that, just the whole message, because we all would agree, if you watch Star Wars: A New Hope, Princess Leia is the hero.
It,
like Luke Skywalker is like not who I want to hear about. He's not saving any day or whatever. So you also did Ripley, right? Like, so you got Ripley,
I did it.
Aliens. You do same. Predator stuff. You've done Die Hard. Like, of course, all the Stormtrooper stuff. So.
Yeah, Escape from New York, Aliens, Terminator. That's, you know, I just do like my take on a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I do a lot of just regular military art too, you know, some topical stuff, and that's it. But like, I, you know, it is I don't get, you know, like, you come to my Instagram, you're there to see some cool art. That's it. Like, I don't do, you know, I don't write any, you know, there's nothing really too deep into it. Some people, like, you know, which is nothing wrong with it. You know, like, they draw stuff to represent X, Y, Z and the struggle and this and that. Mine is just, some people like read into my art, and I'm just like, they're like, oh, did you do it because of this? I'm like, no, I did the rule of cool, man. Like, it looks cool, so I drew it like that.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, is that one of your pieces behind you?
Yeah, this is there's another like franchise I really like. It's called Warhammer. Mm. So it's a bunch of it's actually my take on a famous piece of art that they did like in the 80s. Like, I like that heavy metal, you know, like crazy grim apocalyptic war stuff. Yeah. So.
Badass, awesome colors too, man.
It's cool. Do it. It's all bright, but that's pretty much it. You know, like, I have just all this stuff I'm working on right now, and like, and then I sometimes have an idea, but I don't have like the spark to finish it. So I'll sketch it out real quick, and then I'll come back to it. So I got some pretty cool things in the works.
And so you did something with Silence and Light, right?
Yeah. Great group of guys. I'm good friends with them. and my one friend Brad Thomas, name drop, awesome guy,
yeah,
really good dude. So yeah, me and him, he's a New Yorker, so we gelled, mm-hmm, and we did a bunch of, we did a collaboration, did some stuff, and I did some more work for, they have their new album coming out soon. It's awesome. I've heard some of the tracks already. Fantastic. Yeah. So I got to work on them with a couple little things, you know.
Yeah. I tried, he and I have tried probably four different times to link up for the show.
Yeah. Just to reach out to him.
Yeah. We had it almost set up. I think once or twice I got called out for homicide stuff. And then more recently, I think he had some stuff going on, but it's just like, I love their music. I love the message, their background, the art stuff. So it's just, it's cool, like, to see you do a collaboration with someone I'm already awesome following. You know what I mean? Like, oh man, these guys are.
He's legit too, man. He's great. Yo, really, we've become really good friends, you know, and just a lot of cool stuff. But
yeah,
their new album is awesome. I've heard like five of the tracks.
Oh,
like,
I'm sure.
It was funny. He sent me like a month ago, he sent me one of them, and I'm in the car with my wife, and I'm just like, with my phone like this, like, what are you doing?
Hey, it's, and so if people are out there, because I don't want to screw it up, what's the easiest way they can see all your work and order shirts, hoodies, all the stuff that you've got?
You can go, if you just Google Battle Tribe, or you go to the Etsy store and you type in Battle Tribe, mm-hmm, or on Instagram, Matt Rendar, no space, MattRendar. Mm-hmm. There's a link to my store there, and I usually
will repost your stuff, and I'm kind of learning now how to put the links and stuff like that in there. So, because some people have been like, well, hey, what is that? You know, and it's like, there was one I reposted of yours that was like Darth Vader and like stormtroopers and like an atom bomb going off in the background.
Yeah.
And I put like some Monster Magnet, you know, the band Monster Magnet playing in the background. Yeah. And a lot of people were like, I want that like on a shirt, or I want that on a poster. I was like, this is where to go. And then that was kind of what forced me to start trying to put links in the stores. I'm like you. I'm not into like tech stuff. I suck at it, really.
I feel bad. Like when I want to repost somebody's stuff, their icon, their credit doesn't come up. And I'm like, trying to like push some cool content out there. And it just looks like I'm disaster.
Yeah. So when you start,
BC and I need to step up our social media game. It looks like we're using a typewriter, man. It's terrible.
That's pretty much what I'm using. Like, hey, how do I get this pen and paper to transfer onto this device in my hand?
I'm looking at your Etsy page, man. So you do macrame too. That's pretty cool.
I'm just crochet. He does crochet.
No, this is pretty badass.
Oh, thanks, man.
Real badass.
I do, you know, shirts, hoodies, stickers. I do canvas art prints.
The Battle Tribe. It looks like the Hatebreed logo for one of their albums.
It's like
what,
Thrasher.
Yeah, exactly.
I did a bunch. I did I did a Warhammer one, I did a Thrasher one, I did a Supreme one, Metal Gear Solid one's like my favorite.
So how do you go, because I know nothing about like the art and stuff. So how do you use like familiar logos with your own spin on it without like all patents and all that stuff?
Yeah, it's all derivative art, and it's all, what's that word, when parody. It's all parody and stuff.
Got it. Okay. Cool.
You know, everything's so changed and altered and everything. So
yeah.
But
now when you started that like on Etsy and stuff, I know this is a dumb question because you already knew you had 60,000 hits or whatever on Reddit. The demand was now, you knew the demand was now there. Then you provide the product, and this is what I'll say. I'm like a shirt junkie, like a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Junkie. I love t-shirts.
Yeah.
But your quality, if I'm not mistaken, you use, and I don't know if it's next level.
Yeah,
it is next level, right?
Yeah, and the hoodies are independent. The hoodies are independent, but they're like the softest. So that's what I use.
And that's why I say that, because 9 times out of 10, I will not order a shirt if it's not next level or at least something that's more form fitting. I can't get down with like the big box.
The Gildan.
Yeah. I look like I'm wearing my brother's shirt. Like, hey, Otis, can I go out and wear your shirt? Yeah, I can't get down with that.
Yeah, the printer I use, he's awesome. So he's an artist all on his own with the t-shirts and the printing and everything like that. So,
yeah.
But
and I'm switching gears on you, and I apologize.
That's cool.
Do you find that now that you're retired and not slowing down, but able to do more things that you enjoy. If people come along and they go, "Oh man, yeah, I didn't know you were NYPD or you're retired, you know, a cop." Do you feel like that you would be more comfortable now, like talking to them and explaining to them the positives, you know, of the job or whatever?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, 100%. Yeah. Now, like, I just didn't want any, like, what do you call it? Conflict of interest with the job, you know,
yes.
Like, yeah. You can't make money, you know, like, "Oh, I'm an NYPD detective," you know, like, but yeah. Now, you know, I'm retired. It's, you know, that was an awesome chapter in my life. On to the next. It's nice having all this extra time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to work towards Battle Tribe and stuff, and you know, draw on full time now. And, you know, and it's cool because I can just draw throughout the day. There was one thing when I retired, like I was scared about is like, am I going to lose my spark to do any, you know, keep creating and stuff?
Yeah,
nope. You know,
it's like probably twice as much, right?
I have, I have a really good schedule. You know, wake up, you know, whenever, go to the gym, mm-hmm. come home, eat lunch, you know, hang around, putz around a little bit, do some errands. I do a lot of drawing at night. So
okay.
Do you ever get hired to do like a job? Like somebody says, "This is my vision," almost like a tattoo artist would, like, "This is my vision," or do you just do your own thing?
I do my own thing. I get hit up a lot for commission artwork, mm-hmm. and I've done a couple projects, but predominantly I just do my own. I do my own thing. The I did a bunch of stuff. I did a bunch of commercials for Black Rifle Coffee last fall. I did a couple little skits and stuff, and I've done other stuff in the past. So a lot of the work I do, like, I'm so busy. Like, actually, right now I'm doing a collaboration. There's a company, a British company called Quick Draw Card Company. They do decks of cards. So I'm doing a Battle Tribe Quick Draw collaboration with them. So all the cards in the all the face cards are going to be like special operations, law enforcement, U.S. ones. So it's going to be like NYPD Emergency Service, you know, L.A. SWAT, you know, Coast Guard. You might have seen some on my page. I did a fire jumper. The guys that jump into fires out in the Midwest. You know,
smoke jumpers. Yeah.
That was the spot. So I'm working on. So that's like 16 different cards for all the different suits. Mm. So I was like, "Yo, man, NYPD's got to be ace of spades, all right?"
Yeah.
But so I'm doing that collaboration with them. Those will be available in the fall. Those cards and stuff, and there are a bunch of So I just had SHOT Show. Awesome time. I did a collaboration with Cry Precision. I did their charity shirt, did some work with them, and I made a couple connections, and there's a couple of really cool collaborations on the way. I can't talk about them now, but really cool artwork coming. But I can't wait to announce them all. Like, I have it all. Like,
yeah. But know? that's the cool thing too, like, now being retired, that you have that ability to do that. And I don't know, like, it's sad. Like, right now we're in this cycle, like, and Ski and I've done it, where we're talking to, like, I say younger generation, but really just people who are not in law enforcement, but they're thinking about joining. Mm-hmm. And they get hit with so much negativity. And it's kind of like, if you can stick it out and do it for whatever years that you feel are comfortable, do it. It doesn't have to be 30 years or 20 years, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, looking back, you're in a great position. You know, you did what you wanted to do as a cop. You were able to get the assignments that you wanted to do, and you made it to the full retirement. A lot of people don't make it to the full retirement, or they do it for X number of years and then they go, "Yeah, I'm moving on." Like, I don't know. I feel like as a society, we should encourage that. You know what I mean? To encourage people, "Hey, if you want to be a cop, go do it. And then if you don't like it, go do some other job."
Yeah. You know, like, you know, there's different benefits and stuff. You know, I know some people that retired early, you know, they didn't get the full pension or, you know, the full benefits and stuff like that. But, you know, at least they took a shot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My only piece of advice, like, my son is like, just get in and get, don't putz around, you know. You know, that's just me. You know, don't try to find yourself at 31. You know, like, hit the ground running and just, you know, try new stuff. Take tests, you know, apply yourself, you know. And so that's what he's leaving. He signed up for the Army. He's leaving July 25th. So he was able to get an option 40 Ranger contract. So he'll go to infantry, you know, basic and AIT at Benning. Then he'll go into RASP, go into that meat grinder.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he survives that. He'll go to airborne school and then go to a battalion. So, you know, but then I go, man, you know, 18 years old, man, jumping right in, you know. And then,
so then, so his recruiter, or you, were probably able to guide him, because my recruiter was like, "Oh, you want Ranger bat?" Like, yeah. Because I'd read books on Vietnam. You know, like, "Oh, yeah, that's what I want." He's like, "Cool. You'll leave for Fort Benning on this date. And when you get down there, drill sergeant's going to ask who wants to go to airborne school, who wants to go to ranger school, like who wants to go to ranger or to RIP, or back then it was called RIP, okay, you know, for ranger battalion. He's like, you just raise your hand. They'll pull you over. None of that was true. You know what I mean? Like you said, yeah, all that's got to be contract. So if anybody's listening now, thinking about the military, get everything in a contract. Like don't go for the old word of mouth. Yeah. Like, oh, this was going to happen.
You know, well, you know, I actually, a good friend of mine, I actually served in Iraq with. He's, I guess, a recruiter counselor. He's like on the end of his career. So he hit me up and he was like, oh, you know, he was just telling me the pros and, you know, X, Y, Z, all this stuff. And then the next day he texted me. He's like, screenshot, like, you know, there's a certain amount of slots. They have to leave for June of next year. Tell your son to call his recruiter. They're right there right now. So my son was able to get the option 40 contract that guarantees you a shot, you know, through the selection. You know, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to be a ranger, but it gives you, you know, get into ranger battalion, but he's, you know, gives you a shot. But yeah, option 40. If you don't have that, I have heard that they do scout, you know, when you're in, you know, you're basic in AIT, but that's not a guarantee, you know, needs of the Army, but he's able to get an option 40. And I know, like, for special forces, they have like, what, they still have the 18 X-ray program. I have no idea.
Yeah. I think that's what it is. Yeah. When I got to basic and these guys were like, oh yeah, I got a $6,000 signing bonus. And I've got, like, one dude had Hawaii in his contract. Then when he graduated, he went to 25th.
That's pretty cool.
And I was like, how
do you, like, how's it going? But like, here's another thing too. Like, I was in third ID, and before my second deployment, a lot of dudes showed up with all airborne wings, and we're like, who the hell are these guys? And they were all like guaranteed to go to 170, not 173rd. Who's in Italy?
Yeah, 173rd.
I think it was like five guys that are supposed to go there, and third ID was getting ready to deploy to Iraq, and they moved all those guys, got taken after airborne school and sent to mechanized. So they were all like,
yeah. But I've heard you talk about some of your stuff, like it's like what you were doing overseas, and you know, like every unit has their their identity or whatever. Like you said, 173rd, like Third Herd, you know, they've got a history in Vietnam and stuff. But like Third ID was in the mix when you were in, right? I mean, like you were. Yeah. You mind talking about that? Like walking us through some of that? Yeah.
So I wasn't there for the invasion. So I got there. When I went to Third ID, Third ID had three brigades. They have like four brigades now. First, second, and third. I was assigned the first brigade. First brigade got to correct me if I'm wrong, anybody, got to Kuwait in January of 2003. The invasion kicked off March 19th. So my battalion, I was in 27 infantry. They were attached to 369 armor. My company was actually attached to the armor element that went through the Kabbalah Gap and seized the airport. So like all the guys in my platoon were all like bad motherfuckers. So I got there in the end of April as a replacement, because there was people that got killed. There was people that had a family emergencies or whatever that got flown back to the rear. So they needed people to go. So I get to Kuwait. I fly C-130 into Baghdad, get picked up at the airport. There's like mortar fire landing on the airport, like crazy. I'm like, it was like a movie. All these black ones flying by, like 101st and shit. And then we ride in deuce and a half through Baghdad, and I link up with my unit. They were really cool with me, but it was definitely kind of like the whole Vietnam thing, like you're the new guy and stuff. So I didn't really see any action or anything. It was kind of like, you know what it was, is that Thunder Run, the whole shock and awe, the Iraqis were like down and out, man. Like they did not, the insurgency was like in its infancy. They didn't really know what was going on. I left, I think in like September, our whole division redeployed back. During that, the insurgency started kicking off. Like the insurgents started figuring out how to kill us. Oh, they got light-skinned Humvees. We can IED this and that. Like it was just like the beginning of it. So we go back. I go back to Fort Stewart, you know, do the whole train up 2004. And then I deploy for my second deployment to Samarra, Iraq in 2005 inside the Sunni Triangle. And that was like the blood and guts part of my my military career. It's where I saw the action, the combat, and you know, you pick a flavor of story. I got it, you know. But the great thing though is my platoon really didn't have too much of a shakeup. Not too many people left, so I had a lot of bad dudes with me my second deployment. So I had a lot of great leadership, and it was, we were very aggressive, and I give a lot of my experience, the pluses, it was all because of the guys I was with over there in that platoon. Great, good leadership, lieutenant, platoon sergeant, you know, squad leaders, team leaders, everybody was rocking and rolling at top performance, which was really, you know, really a benefit to us, you know, fighting them, the insurgents and all that stuff.
And being able for them to pass down that experience, like when you go on patrol and then they tell you, hey, do this, don't do that, you know, because they've already seen it, done it, applied it. Instead of having that institutional amnesia, like what we're seeing now in police work, where the generation that's been the crime fighters are now starting to retire and not passing on those same skills, you know, to the newer or, you know, newer officers, like, hey, this is how you do surveillance, street level surveillance, or this is how you do, you know, fugitive, like this is how you work the circles of their relatives. This is how we're going to find where someone wanted for murders, you know, live like all the little tools or the tricks in trade. I've heard you talk about on other podcasts, like in very, very specific detail about the shootouts you guys survived, the explosions. And I would tell anybody listening right now to go to that. We'll post some of the links to the other podcast because, and one I want to say is like DTD podcast. Yeah. It's been a little while back, but like you got into a lot of detail with that. And I always don't want to plug other podcasts and help people out. So we'll post all your other podcast episodes you've been on and future ones too, because you've always got a lot to talk about, and that's why I appreciate it. And it's like it's one of those things, like once you like open up the can like that, like some people go, yeah, I was with 3rd ID, and then other people are like, oh, he must not have done a whole lot, and then you're like, no, dude, like he
it's wild, man. The you know what it is like, just the real thing is like they and everything with law enforcement and the military and things like that, that experience is so precious, man. You know, and it's, you know, it saves lives and saves time and all, you know, all the above. But it's crazy, man. Like it was funny. I was talking to my wife and what do you call it? Some of the scenarios that happened over there, like you realize later in life how like fucking insane they were and stuff. It's like, we used to do 4-man OPs in the middle of the Samara. We just walk out there. I mean, we'd have a QRF like waiting in the motor pool of Bradley's and everything, but we just four of us would just walk off in the night with like the PBS-14s and just go set up an OP and just wait for guys to come out. And I remember there's a couple times I felt like a real badass. It's like one time, so we had a logistical pack, which was like all the supplies and stuff. They run a convoy, they get attacked, they get hit with IEDs and everything, and they would come 3 times a week to bring us hot chow and supplies and you know, like mail and stuff like that. And then as soon as they dropped all that shit, they'd eat and get the hell out of Dodge. So we're walking out to do one of these night OP, you know, hunter killer missions. So it's like 4 of us, we're walking out and we're walking past like the Hemets and the Humvees, and they're all looking at us like, oh my God, you fuckers are going out there. And we're like, I'm like this, like, bye. And I just disappeared in the darkness. You know, like those guys are like, they're looking at us like we're never coming home ever again. Just before we're walking out there, you know? It's so funny. As I'm walking away, I'm like, yeah, fuck that guy. I'm badass.
Yeah. That's how Ski used to feel when he would sneak through like an abandoned house window to go set up surveillance in like a crack dominated area. He'd be like, man, I'm sitting in here with like empty 40s and like, you know, I won't go anywhere. What's in an abandoned house near a crack spot? But
every time we record an episode and I listen to other people's stories, man, I feel so insignificant in this world. Oh, like, man, I need to go do something badass before I go to bed tonight, man.
The crazy thing is, the military, the infantry's been doing that. Going back forever. Like you can read stories like Harlem Hellfighters who were doing like LPOPs out past the wire in World War I. And getting cut off and like German squads coming in and they're fighting with knives, like going through dude's chest and stuff, like hand to hand. Same shit that would happen to y'all. If that would have happened, four people, you know,
four dudes in a radio, you know, you're out there.
Yeah. So, but it's almost like the smaller the element, the less you're going to get detected too. If you're doing everything.
Yeah.
Right.
No,
but
yeah.
Still, that's crazy, but dude.
Still like, yeah. You know, like that. Yeah. That's what they're about. Got rolled up on, you know, it's crazy, man. You know, and like all the gunfights I was ever in Iraq were all like street to street, roof to roof, roof to street, like a little bit of distance. And, you know, never happened inside a house. you know, like going in the house, somebody's getting shot. Like, you know, like all this CQB shit, somebody's getting shot. That's why, like, law enforcement, you're at that, you're at those, like, close range, you know, like you're helping somebody with something and then they turn on you or a guy pops out. It's just a tactical nightmare, but it's just, you know, something that law enforcement has to deal with. So,
definitely. Yeah, and that's funny you bring that up, right? Because people are like, oh, yeah, I was in the military, so I've got all this tactical training and this and that. Yeah, but your rules of engagement are like a complete 180 in law enforcement. So you get these recruits that come in because BC and I taught, you know, a lot of academy stuff and a bunch of different classes. But you get these recruits that were like you, like high speed, low drag. And you'd have to tell them like, yeah, I understand that your tactics are way more badass than this basic movement we're teaching you. But you got to think what your who your customers are. You know, we're not going in this house to shoot and kill everybody.
Yeah,
we're
no,
going 100%. In this house to keep our asses alive and hopefully go help somebody that called 911. You know, and that's a tough barrier to knock down sometimes. And some people can't turn it off. Man, I remember this one dude in one of the recruit classes. We were doing some stairway clearing and you know, just some very basic movements, and he just got so mad at the tactic we were teaching. He's like, oh, but that would never work. And it's like, dude, it will work in this environment. Like, we're not in Iraq, you know?
No, 100%.
Yeah.
Also, too, like I'm in your world. Like, you know, I'm the big military guy, but you're in my police academy learning how to do police shit. Like, you you have to humble yourself and listen. And also, too, like, what's the point of, you know, hey, that won't work, that work. Do that in your head. Apply what you think is good for you in your scenario when you're out on the street. You know, this is not the time or the place to have a big macho, you know, thing. You know, you just take, and I've had some awesome training in the police department. I had some crappy, you know, like I did some really good low light police training. I was like, wow, man, like I never experienced this, you know. I'm very honest, you know.
Yeah.
But you take what you need, you know, but like you're in your world. Like I'm here to do your, you know, do to teach me this job, take what you can, you know?
Hey, and the other thing I want to point out, you know, you're talking about doing these real badass things with just you and three other dudes. You can accomplish a lot with four people, you know, especially translate it into law enforcement world.
Absolutely.
Like, dude, you get four squared away guys or girls on a squad that are all like-minded. You train together and you really work to be the best at what you do, you can get a lot of shit done with just four people.
Absolutely. You know, there was a lot of times on the street. I did midnights in the beginning of my career. And you know, there's only a couple cars and like, you know, a bad call comes over, everybody goes there and handles it. And you know, I applied a lot of like military tactics. A lot of the guys I was really good. And like I remember my first partner, me and him partnered up, great dude. And I was like, all right, like day one, I'm like, all right, we drove out. I worked in a precinct that was on a beach. So there was like a, you know, the parking lot. I had my kids chalk, like sidewalk chalk, and I drew rooms out. I'm like, this is how we clear rooms, you know? Mm-hmm. And I showed him how to do it. And he's like, all right. And then like over time, he was like second nature. Never was in the military, never did Iraq. But me and him were on the same page of paper. And, you know, we were able to move around. There's a lot of different things, you know?
That's awesome, man. Just a little quick, what do you call it, hip pocket training?
That's it.
Yeah. Man, you can do it anywhere, anytime, man. But I think it's a dying breed too.
Well, and the secret is being ego free. Like we always talk about that.
Right.
Like, like you just said, like that person's willing to learn from you, but you're also willing to learn from an officer who's been on that beat for like 8 years and goes, look, 100%. I know this isn't tactically sound, but we're getting ready to, you know, whatever, hit this cut, or we're getting ready to, you know, squatting this shadow over here that seems crazy because we don't have a lot of cover, but that shadow, whatever, is gonna you know, work with us for right now. Just hang with me. But that ability to go, okay, you tell me what you're telling, and if it's coming from a vantage point of you've been there and done it, okay. Like so with Ski, like when he's talking about teaching, same thing in the academy. If he mentions something about drug work or street level stuff or flipping informants or whatever, it's like, yeah, listen to Ski. He's been there and done it. You know what I mean? Like it's like put the ego aside and just kind of listen to what he's got going on. So
absolutely. You know, it's not about your ego. It's like what works, you know?
Exactly.
Like,
I
don't know, like, and we've all heard stories of the baddest motherfucker in the world and they get taken out by, you know, a 14-year-old kid or some other, you know, like any circumstance, you know, that's the thing too, is like, you can be the most baddest dude in the world, but you get cold clocked or you get, A shot of opportunity takes you out and you go down, your partner, he's your lifeline.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So switching gears a little bit, we've talked about your military, your police, your art. Do you dig music, man? Like, did you do anything with music?
Man,
like,
I dig music. I hate, the one thing I hate about music, people ask me, it's always like a brain fart. It's like, what do you listen to? And I'm like, right. You know, but yeah, no, 100%. I listen to music.
Yeah. So like growing up, I always, when I would draw, I would listen to art, or listen, when I would draw, I would listen to music, which would in turn kind of influence what I'm drawing or whatever. Do you do that? Or do you just like kind of throw some music on in the background? Or like, is there anything where it influences anything you do?
I listen to a ton of different stuff. Sometimes when I draw, I listen to music. Sometimes I listen to, talk or whatever, political news crap on YouTube and stuff. But music's awesome though, and it's great. So name drop, my friend Brad.
Yeah.
I was like, one day I was like, oh bro, can you do me a favor? And he's like, yeah, man, whatever you need. And I was like, can you just do like Battle Tribe jingle, like 20 seconds, 30 seconds? Because I needed music for the little videos I make for my content and stuff. I always like try to take some of my drawings and like make little videos and stuff. So he was like, yeah, no problem. Boom. Next thing I know, I have like 17 different tracks. He gave me electric guitar, his drummer, this guy, awesome guy, Justin Myers. Awesome. They both did a bunch of music for me. And like, I added it to like different content. Really cool. So I have all this, like, people are like, what is that tune? I'm like, it was written just for Battle Tribe.
Yeah.
So cool, man. But music, man. So what do you want to know? What type of music I listen to? I listen to.
That's funny. Real quick, you touched on it. Like, I don't have any artistic creativity in my brain at all, man. It's terrible. But anyway, like our little intro music, BC and I, we had a guy when we first started this that was kind of helping us producing this and that. And we literally just talked out this vision that we had. And he was just very gifted with the music stuff. He put that together overnight. We hit play the next morning and it was 100% what we were asking for.
Yeah. Is it awesome? Like,
it
like,
is. It just, yeah.
So cool. Like, I draw. So, like, I'm impressed by, what certain aspects and stuff like that. But, like, to me, like, music is like magic, like, magician, all magic out there.
Yeah.
And then this, what's the other thing, too? Carpentry. Like my buddies came over and they worked on my house when I first bought it, and it was just like, it's like magic. I'm like, oh my god, like putting up frames and stuff. I'm like, I can't do it. I just can't do it. I could draw space marines, but I don't feel bad.
I can actually frame out a room and do all that. So I kind of feel cool.
Big deal.
I was just talking to somebody about like building a deck. Like what did it would entail to build a deck or to actually kind of like add on to a deck. And I'm like, I got to tell you right now, I don't know anything about, but it's horrible when I put together furniture. You know what I'm saying? Like a little particle board bookshelf or something. Drives me crazy. And Ski over here is like, hey, I had about 4 hours, so I built a deck or I built raised flower beds. That was another thing we were talking about. It's like, can you build or put in these raised flower beds or whatever? So Ski can do all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I know what a hammer is. I know it hits nails, but man, this dude's over here like Bob Vila. You know what I mean? Like, okay, I got you. So what do you listen to, man?
I listen to like 80s rock, 90s rock, friggin' some death metal, man. I'm a big friggin', I like the Bolt Thrower. That's friggin' that's some stuff I listen to when I'm drawing. It's so funny. So I was out. I met this really good dude who just made nameless. I don't want to name drop all over the place, but he had a Bolt Thrower tattoo on him. I was like, oh my God. So, what do you call it? Big 90s, like friggin' Nirvana, Metallica, like all the classics, AC/DC, friggin' some, early 90s rap, whatever. I like some of the, Blink 182. I was a big Sublime fan, like there's all different genres all over the place.
When you mentioned Nirvana, it's now interesting to see how they've come back. Like, heavy, man. Like a lot of people our age now are even saying, yeah, I wasn't so much of a Nirvana fan in the 90s when it came out, but now can appreciate it. And I saw a dude the other day, a young guy, man, really cool kid, but he's wearing a Nirvana shirt. And it's actually the flyer, like the Nirvana flyer from 1991, I think. And it has all the dates on the back, like their tour, with, you know, in 91, that was like right around the time when they broke big. It may have even been right before, if I remember right. But, and I mentioned this on a previous episode, I believe, but two of my buddies used to do a fanzine, like where they take pictures of the bands and stuff and write articles, and interviews, the old school stuff, you know? And so I was telling them about, like, yeah, man, that show listed right there, my buddies went to, and the bassist for Nirvana, or the guitarist, were actually snuck them in the side door, and they hung out with Nirvana at that time. And because that's what they did, you know, back then. But it was just, and there's a lot more to the story, but I was just like, man, here's this guy who's very young, getting into music, and he's wearing a Nirvana shirt that 20 years ago or 40 or 30 years ago or whatever was like just a regular band, and then all of a sudden they blow up and have influenced so many people now. So
no, absolutely,
this might be an unpopular opinion, and I'm diehard 90s music, right?
Oh,
and I appreciate Nirvana. I really do. I still to this day couldn't understand the Kurt Cobain, just the mania behind.
Oh yeah, I know.
Like, cause I don't like the guy. I've never seen an interview where I'm like, oh man, he is a pretty cool dude.
No,
and I understand he was on drugs and the whole nine yards, but like, I don't understand why people like him so much.
Yeah, no, I'm on board with that too. You know, I didn't even watch the whole thing, like the documentary he had. I was just like, but like also too, there's a lot of art that's out there, and I give two shits about the artist. You know, like. Right.
Yeah.
Like I'm a big, what's his name? Like Quentin Tarantino movies, love him.
Mm-hmm.
But his political things, I'm just like what are you talking about? You know, what are you talking about? You know, like, you know, and like the classic is like people that make gun movies that are anti-gun. It's just like you know, so I'm able to separate people, you know, from their art and stuff, but same thing, you know, like
Yeah, I'm with Ski. Like when Nirvana first hit, I was more into like more positive, like New York hardcore, more just like about your own internal change. Like, hey, it's not cool to go out there and flip off everybody and smash bottles and tear the scene up. It's more like, what are you doing to help? Or what are you doing to kind of learn more about your own self? But so it's kind of weird. Like Nirvana was like blowing up, and then all these other bands were kind of like it allowed them, kind of like when you mentioned Blink 182.
Yeah.
It's like Green Day blows up.
Green Day.
And then there's this, Blink 182, Sum 41, or like all these other bands are kind of getting access to the mainstream as well. But any hip hop? You listen to any hip hop or no?
Not really.
Yeah. No, that's what I'll say. Like the old school stuff, I'll drop sometimes. But
oh yeah, like you know, was like Tupac and some. That's not.
That's what I'm saying. It's like it's.
Yeah. Oh yeah, 100%. You know.
Yeah. Nowadays, I kind of feel like it got hijacked. It's like anything, man. Some music scenes are great, and some kind of die out. They'll come back.
Yeah, you mentioned Sublime, man, and that's gonna be Sublime, the band that's gonna be my band. You know, we always BC and I always kind of throw something out there for people. Go check this out. But the album that came out shortly after he OD'd that he actually never got to reap the benefits at. Oh, no, the original self-titled Sublime with Garden Grove and all that stuff. But the song Same in the End, I think it's the third or fourth song on the track.
Awesome,
holy
man.
Shit. But, yeah, I mean, that band can rip it. But then you can listen to Bradley Knoll just sit on an acoustic guitar high as a kite. And he's a freaking lyrical and musical genius, man.
And I didn't get into him until he was dead. Like, he was dead. When did he die? Like, 94? Like, I really didn't get into him until, like, 96. I had, like, every album and friggin' I love the album. Live album is awesome.
So good. Yeah, yeah.
That's a good one because literally probably Saturday afternoon was having that discussion. Sublime, Wrong Way. So the song Wrong Way, I think it's off that album.
Yeah, same album.
It's like an upbeat, almost like ska song. But then when you listen to the lyrics, you're like, oh, man, that hurts my heart. Like that's But the way they can switch up, you can tell like Sublime had that Fishbone influence. Like for anybody listening, go Google Fishbone. You're welcome. It's one of the greatest bands ever. Prior to like Sublime and that whole, even like Red Hot Chili Peppers kind of thing.
Yeah,
you just fuse all these different sounds together. Fishbone were like the masters of doing that, which sadly not a lot of people know. So Ski, you're going with Sublime. That's you're digging them, and
specifically
you're pushing that. You're pushing Sublime.
Specifically, Same in the End. Sublime. I don't know what it is about that song, but like when I hear it, I want to run through walls, man. It's a mosh pit song, dude.
Nah, it's good song.
So are you going with Bolt Thrower, Matt? You want people to be like, hey, check it out.
And so I was the other day, I was like I was YouTubing Bolt Thrower, and I was like the best of Bolt Thrower albums, like, ah, cool. And they're like, my favorite album is the one they said was the shittiest, and I'm like, I guess I'm not really that's the thing, is I'm not really like a connoisseur of anything, you know, like,
right?
I like this, and people are like, that's bullshit, that's fucking, you're a sellout. I'm like, okay.
That's how Ski is. If I mention that I like Metallica's album Load, he's like, because I'm not the biggest Metallica fan like Ski. So I do remember the Load album, and I really did kind of dig the stripped down, more traditional kind of rock sound. Yeah. But I like their old stuff like Master of Puppets and stuff. But
Dude, one of my favorite Metallica songs is Low Man's Lyric. And that comes from the Load Reload era, man. And it's just,
I gotcha.
It's amazing.
So I'm all right. So you got Sublime, you got Bolt Thrower. I'm going with Ski. I can never. I can't pick one. I'm gonna go with a few. I'm gonna go a little soft and go with Bahamas. I can't remember if I've even mentioned. Have I mentioned Bahamas, Ski?
I don't think so. No.
Go with Bahamas. Stronger Than That's a good song, but any of their stuff, it's like just really mellow listening. But I got turned on to them recently, man. Love it. I'll throw it on, man, and listen to it a lot of times late in the evening, and just
you know, I can tell that there's an emotional attachment to what you're talking about, because like you just kind of like gazed off to the side.
I did.
It actually made Matt and I uncomfortable, man. It was like, what was it?
Ski, you're a master of body language. I didn't even. We call that leakage. We call that like body language.
You got all emotional and blushing.
Okay. So yeah, Bahamas. Y'all check out Bahamas. You can't go wrong.
Fucking Bolt Thrower, baby.
Bolt Thrower, Sublime. Also, though, I'm gonna throw a plug in there that, man, I hope here in the future, in the next few weeks, maybe we can get them on the show. Is it's a newer band to me, but they've probably been around long enough that they've made music their lives. But a band called Old Heavy Hands.
Okay.
And Old Heavy Hands. I can't really describe it other than if you had a bunch of musicians get together and create some music that you can just throw on and listen to and have a fire pit going, but probably listen to the lyrics and also get something from it. But I don't even know how to compare it. Like a little bit of country in there, a little bit of like old 70s maybe.
My first impression, because I listened to a few, is they gave me like that Counting Crows vibe.
Okay.
A little bit from it. They definitely have a 90s sound to them.
Yeah.
That could be way off because I only listened to one or two songs.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So right now they've been posting. I think they've got a new album that's out right now or about to be released. But they've got a single out with a video, but it's called Between You and Me. So they posted on Instagram a few times, and I've reposted some of their art, like their they did a take on one of the Bass companies or something. But they're called Old Heavy Hands.
Old Heavy Hands?
Old Heavy Hands.
My good friend Justin Myers, he's the drummer in Silence of Light, but he has another band. It's called Broken Side. I did some artwork for their album. So I did one of their singles, Cartographer, and then their album just came out last year, Fathom. I did some of the artwork inside there. It was like a zombie Moby Dick eating people in a boat and shit. So definitely check them out. Yeah, Broken Inside.
And that's the drummer.
No,
right?
Side, just Broken Side.
Oh, Broken Side. Sorry.
Yeah. Gotcha. That's another band that he has. I think they have two albums out. So I love that shit. And they're like, yo, you want to do some artwork? I'm like, absolutely. So I did a bunch of stuff for them.
Yeah, one of the guys in that band, I think, knew the editor from Skillset magazine I was writing for. The guy was in the Marine Corps.
Silence of Light or Broken Side?
Yeah, I'm sorry, in Silence and Light. Yeah.
Silence Light, yeah.
I want to say maybe bassist, but it's just cool, like their background too, being military and stuff. So
yeah, a lot of special operations guys.
Yeah, you know.
So really cool.
Well, good, dude. Well, I'm glad you came on, man. I'm glad we finally got around to it.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, dude. We're the same way, man. Ski, you got anything else, man? Any parting words?
No, man. I just appreciate your time and fun conversation.
Yeah, pleasure to see you, man. Good time, man.
So everybody go check out. Again. Yeah, definitely. Everybody go check out Battle Tribe. Check out Matt Rendar on Instagram. And check out some Sublime Bolt Thrower. Old Heavy Hands, and obviously some Bahamas.
Bahamas.
Write it down.
All right. Disruptors out.